Ms. Kippel.
Ms. Kippel, I'm sorry.
Okay.
Finally done.
Very good. May it please the court, my name is Alice Kippel, and I represent the appellant court of Stahl BV. I will address two of the three issues appealed by Corus, namely the Department of Commerce's decision to reclassify Corus's JIT sales as CEP versus EP, as well as the Department of Commerce's determination that Corus had absorbed anti-dumping duties.
Is the second of those we received?
Yes, yesterday a letter from the government pertinent to the second. Is it still a live issue?
Your Honor, our contention would be that it is for three reasons, and that's the duty absorption question. With respect to the government's contention that the issue is moot, our position that it's not moot. And that is, first of all, by statute, and that's 19 U.S.C. 1675, parens A, parens 4, the duty absorption finding that Commerce makes is to be used only by the International Trade Commission in its injury determination in a sunset review. The ITC sunset review as to the order on hot rolled steel from the Netherlands is still pending. So from that perspective, the issue is not moot. Secondly, while the order on hot rolled steel from the Netherlands has been revoked as a result of the Department of Commerce's sunset review determination, the time for appeal of that determination has not yet run. And thirdly, the Department of Commerce's sunset determination hinged in large part on the revocation of the order resulting from the Section 129 determination, which determination has already been challenged in front of the Court of International Trade by the U.S. producers. For those three reasons, we don't believe that the issue is moot, and that judicial economy would counsel that this court should proceed to decide the issue, because at this point it's still live.
Well, the order says that this April 9th memorandum says this order will be revoked.
That's correct, Your Honor. There is a question pending as to the time periods during which the order is revoked. And my colleague, Mr. Cunningham, when he addresses the issue that he'll be addressing, which revolves around a change in U.S. law, he may get into the question as to the time periods of revocation. However, the order was revoked with respect to entries after a certain date, and there's still questions pending as to the effect of that revocation with respect to prior unliquidated entries, which these would constitute because these came in prior to the revocation effective date. Does that respond to Your Honor's question? Okay. With respect, I might as well move on to that issue since we're on that issue. Our position is that both the determination as to duty absorption as well as Corus's JIT sales, neither of the determinations recognizes business realities, and in that respect, the determinations are flawed, as are the CIT's affirmance of those determinations.
Counsel, don't you have an exhaustion problem here?
It's our position, Your Honor, that there are several exceptions to the exhaustion doctrine that apply with respect to the duty absorption finding. First of all, we have the futility exception. The Commerce Department has applied a standard for about 10 years at this point that no one's been able to meet. The Commerce Department demands that if you're going to be found not to have absorbed anti-dumping duties as a respondent, you need to prove that you have an irrevocable commitment from a customer to pay whatever anti-dumping duties will ultimately become due whenever that's due. As a matter of business reality, it's not logical to think that a customer is going to commit to pay at some unknown time in the future some unknown amount that it has no control over. The Court of International Trade, indeed, in a case that we cite at page 56 of our brief, the Fabrique de Fer de Charleroi case, recognize that as a commercially, as a matter of commercial sense, it's not a tenable requirement. Nevertheless, so far, no one has called Commerce on it, and the Court of International Trade has continued to sustain the standard that, as a practical business matter, no company could ever meet. And indeed, no one has met it. And it was our position that it would be futile for Corus to continue to argue that particular point. We did raise the issue after the Commerce Department said it was conducting a duty absorption inquiry. We provided information on the record. Commerce Department in the preliminary determination said, sorry, Forrest, you haven't satisfied the standard. You've absorbed anti-dumping duties consistent with our irrebuttable presumption, which we maintain as an irrebuttable presumption. So therefore, for us to continue to argue the matter.
Ms. Kipple, your time is up. Do you want to give the rest to Mr. Cunningham, or should we start to use his time?
No, I'll give the rest of the time to Mr. Cunningham, and then maybe we'll have some rebuttal time. Thank you.
Thank you.
Ms. Kipple is always generous with me. Your Honor, it's good to see you again. Your Honor, it's good to meet you for the first time. I'm here to argue one specific issue that relates to me. So whether the Department of Commerce, in light of the now completed implementation of WTO decisions, has the authority to impose duties on the imports that are subject to this appeal. This is not a challenge to the implementation. It's not a challenge to the methodology used by Commerce to compute the duties. It is a question of whether Commerce has authority to impose duties when what they have done is implementation has changed the law, that is, the methodology used.
Before the law was changed, before this order was revoked, there was a different regime in place.
That is correct.
Which, of course, has upheld in numerous decisions.
That's correct. We don't.
What would be our authority to retrospectively change that law beyond the date set by the
definition,
Department?
The definition of retrospectivity that this court has adopted in this situation, that is, the change of the law relating to an anti-dumping proceeding, is that it's retrospective only if it relates to, and retrospectively turns on the date of liquidation, not on the date of entry. There has been no liquidation of these entries. The new law, under your definition in Parkdale, applies to the new entries. That would be our position. Frankly, Your Honor, it's not for you to decide that now, though, because the Supreme Court has told you that you need to remand that to the Department of Commerce.
Well,
sure.
When you say the Supreme Court, you mean in the two Supreme Court cases that you've relied on, not in this, any of these proceedings.
No. The precedent of the Supreme Court is that where a change in law has occurred while a case is on appeal, where the change in law has implications for the outcome of the case, it is to be remanded to the Department of Commerce to determine, in the first instance, how that should affect the change.
Where it isn't clear what the agency would do. It's a kind of
correct.
A kind of application. Of
correct, and I'm going to explain to you why it's really not clear what the agency would do.
Well, okay, but you're going to focus, I assume, on the fourth administrative review.
I'm absolutely going to focus on that and other aspects. Let me just briefly review for you what Commerce has done, what the U.S. has done in implementation here, which is now complete, which we don't challenge. Change the law in a 123 proceeding, a proceeding which does not have any language in the statute or in the SAA that refers to application to future entries. And as such, the governing rule for that is Parkdale, not anything in the SAA. Second, they have applied that change in law to this case, this proceeding, recomputed the margin, found the original determination of dumping under the new methodology is not valid. There is, I submit to you, no valid determination of dumping, therefore, at the moment. Finally, in a separate proceeding, section 129, they have revoked the order in this case. They have said that they have revoked it as to future entries, and they have said explicitly that they have taken no position yet on the application of that revocation to prior unliquidated entries. And let me read you what Commerce has said just 2 weeks ago on that point.
Where did they say that precisely?
I'm going to read that to you. And they said
is
in two places.
Is that on record or is that something?
In two places. First of all, in the fourth review, they said section 129 does not speak to the applicability of this revocation to prior entries. They remain subject to potential duty liability. Potential clearly means they're right where they were before. That is, duty liability is to be decided by Commerce in the review proceeding, which they have not done. Okay.
Well, but
Where are you reading? Where are you going to read from?
I'm going to read from their brief 2 weeks ago to the Court of International Trade in a separate challenge to another review in this case. If I may, I will read.
Is that supplied to us here in the supplemental material? Or?
I'm afraid it's not. It was just done very recently.
A couple days ago.
It is entirely consistent with what they said in the 129 determination, which they said this determination doesn't apply. It has no relevance to the prior unliquidated entries. It's consistent with what they said in the fourth review. Doesn't apply. We have to make a determination in the review. And what they said was, the statute does not speak to prior unliquidated entries except to say that a Section 129 determination itself does not affect those entries. The government has never stated otherwise. Therefore, they have a decision left to make. What we're telling you is, you need to remand it to them to make it. Now, I wish I didn't have to make this argument. CORA says multiple millions of dollars in cash deposits, which it wants to get back, and it thoroughly believes that there is no authority now for imposing duties. But unfortunately, the cases don't allow me to make that argument. They say that you're not to make that judgment in the first instance. You are to remand it to Commerce to do so. And that's what we're urging you to do here. And there's good reason to do that, because it will be a complicated decision.
You want to reserve the rest of your rebuttal time?
I would like to reserve the rest for rebuttal.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Ms. Burke, I believe, will be first.
May it please the court. I wasn't planning to, but I'll start with zeroing. And I'd like to point out a couple of things that have happened in the very recent past that we didn't inform the court of. The arguments that Mr. Cunningham is making right now with respect to possibility of a remand have already been made in the court's petition for cert, which the Supreme Court denied, I think it was either June 25th or June 27th. So at any rate, a couple of weeks.
You're not asking us to read anything into a cert denial, right?
Well, other than that argument.
Other than that cert was denied.
Correct. There are two events that occurred that CORUS relies upon. First, Commerce's section, what they call Section 123 determination, which...
Can you address the comment that Mr. Cunningham was making last when he said in a recent petition to the Court of International Trade, you had pointed out that government policy has changed and it would necessitate a remand?
It's absolutely not what we said. I believe that what Mr. Cunningham is referring to is the government's brief, maybe two things. The government's brief before the Court of International Trade in our motion, in our hearing for a preliminary injunction, CORUS's hearing, and also the government's brief in opposition to CORUS's petition for reconsideration from the Court of International Trade, which incidentally was denied last week. In that brief, we said what we've always said, which is a Section 129 determination by statute operates prospectively and does not affect prior unliquidated entries, which means it doesn't speak to prior unliquidated entries. It says neither one thing nor the other about what shall happen to them.
Well, if it says nothing about them, take me to the next step in your logic. Nothing's been said. The policy's changed. What do we do about it?
Well, the policy has changed with respect to investigations. The policy has not changed with respect to administrative reviews. And Commerce has been quite clear about how...
These are unliquidated items.
These are unliquidated items subject to an administrative review.
And
so
do we know what that administrative review will do with those unliquidated items if we send it back? Assume now we send it back. Is it certain that you're going to say, oh, these are subject to the order in place?
Yes.
And that's just because. And why?
It's because Commerce has already explained exactly how it intends to apply the new methodology such that there is one.
And that's the fourth administrative review that you provided, or one of the parts provided.
Correct. And it's really everywhere. but in the 123 determination, Congress says this applies to new and pending investigations. In the 129 determination, Congress explains that it applies effective April 23rd, 2007, and does not apply to anything, any entries that occur prior to April 23rd. And then we have the fourth administrative review on top of all of that, which makes quite clear that Congress did not intend to change its policy with respect to reviews.
My understanding of our law is that we place the emphasis on the liquidation date rather than the administrative review. I think that was Mr. Cunningham's argument as well.
Well, I think what Mr. Cunningham is trying to say is that when Congress has perhaps changed its methodology and not explained how it intends that change to be applied, that perhaps a remand may be appropriate. But that's not what we have here. We have Congress's very clear statements about exactly how this changing methodology is supposed to apply. And I mean, the overarching thing that the court has to remember is that the changing methodology does not apply to administrative reviews at all. It only applies to investigations.
Why is that from a policy standpoint? Why apply it to average-to-average but not average-to-transaction valuations?
Well, what Commerce is trying to do in an investigation is different from what it's trying to do in a review. So, for example, in an investigation, Commerce is trying to determine whether dumping is at a sufficient level to justify the imposition of an order, whereas in an administrative review, by statute, Commerce is only looking at entries and trying to determine whether specific entries have been dumped. So, although Commerce has not articulated this rationale in any domestic proceeding, as far as I know, yet, it would make sense.
Mr. Cunningham says he's recalculated it and there no dumping.
I can't really speak to that. I don't think I would be capable of recalculating it, but this is obviously a pretty sophisticated computer operation that Commerce has going on.
And am I characterizing our Timken decision right? Tell me if I am. Because our Timken decision sort of validated your zero-ring methodology. It distinguished, at least my read of it, between administrative reviews and investigative inquiries. Am I remembering it right?
It did. The court in Corus went on to say that for purposes of the actual statutory language, it's kind of a distinction without a difference, because the statutory language that Congress relies on in investigations and reviews is the same statutory language that permits zeroing. But as the court also held, the statute doesn't require zeroing. And so to the extent that Commerce changes its methodology in some instances and not others, that change in methodology is going to be subject to the same standard of review that any change in methodology that Commerce decides to impose, which is whether it's reasonable. And perhaps that will be an issue someday.
How much money are we talking about here? How much is caught in the administrative review process?
In this particular review?
Yeah,
I think
this
it's
one.
Somewhere in the neighborhood of $3 to $4 million. Mr. Cunningham can be more specific.
Okay, that's what we're talking about.
We have our answer from behind.
I'd like to quickly move on to the other two issues in my remaining couple of minutes. First, with respect to Commerce's classification of CEP and EP sales, the statute requires Commerce, first and foremost, to determine the price at which a product is sold or agreed to be sold. So the first thing we need is a price. The documents that Corus has provided Commerce are in the form of frame agreements and pro forma invoices, which Corus has explained to us are documents that are changed. Well, I don't want to put words in their mouth, but they said our changes are not infrequent and changes are not hypothetical. So to the extent that Commerce is obligated by the statute to determine a price, an accurate price, to base its EP and CEP calculation.
Can we talk about the frame agreements for 1 second and just whether or not Commerce has changed its analysis of the frame agreements as to whether they are agreed to be sold, whether they satisfy the frame agreements on their face certainly look like a confirmation of agreed to sale. But in fact, isn't it the case that Commerce sort of determined after further investigation and questionnaires that, in fact, they weren't agreed to price and quantity and things. In fact, those were still open until the inventory was imported and then there was an actual customer that agreed to pay for them. Is that kind of what happened? Because, you know, obviously there's some concern about Commerce saying in the one instance early on that the frame agreements are the confirmation of a sale, and then later on saying, no, they're not the agreed to sale as of that date.
Is there some concern that Commerce is changing its position? Is that the question?
They've raised a concern that Commerce is changing its position.
Okay.
So.
Well, with respect to what Commerce has done in prior segments of this proceeding, namely the investigation and the first administrative review, Commerce has been pretty consistent. What happened in the investigation is that Commerce actually did rely upon these frame agreements in order to classify, or similar, not these frame agreements, but similar frame agreements, to classify the sales as CEP sales.
Didn't Commerce say, and I'm quoting here, from the Federal Register, provides the final written confirmation of the agreement, when discussing what the frame agreement is. It provides the final written confirmation of the agreement.
Are you reading from the investigation, Federal Register?
Yes. Yeah, 2001.
Right. Well, frankly, the issue wasn't raised or litigated, as far as I recall, in the investigation. What happened in the first administrative review was Commerce determined that it probably had been a mistake in the way that it was treating these frame agreements, and we requested the Court of International Trade to allow us to reclassify them on a remand. And the court, as it notes in its decision here, denied that request. And so what we've done in the second administrative review is entirely consistent with what we wanted to do in the first administrative review. To the extent that it's different from what we did in the investigation, I don't deny that, but Commerce has been clear that it's going in a different direction now.
Ms. Burke, you're into Mr. Eric's comments.
I am, Your Honor. I apologize. Thank you.
We need to ask you a question.
I just wanted to, because of the status of this
Please.
Issue of mootness on the absorption issue, you heard Ms. Kippel's explanation for why, in her view, your submission that mootness is not, this is not moot. Could you respond to that?
Sure. I believe what Ms. Kippel said is that there's still an outstanding determination to be made from the International Trade Commission.
Well, she had three different grounds.
She did. That was the one that I thought was most troubling. But it is in fact not troubling, because all the International Trade Commission can do is make an injury determination where the Department of Commerce has found a likelihood of dumping. And as the Department of Commerce has made clear, there is no likelihood of dumping here.
So it never goes to the
Or it, not that it never goes to it, but that the commission can't actually.
They don't even have occasion to look to likelihood of a material injury, right?
Right. Good point. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Burke. Now, Mr. Harris, you have 4 minutes remaining.
Police Court, I'm Jeffrey Garrish of Skadden Arms, appearing on behalf of the United States Steel Corporation. U.S. Steel, in the time that I have here today, I would like to focus on one of the three issues that's been raised, the zero issue. And U.S. Steel certainly agrees with everything that Ms. Burke said on behalf of the government. Very quickly on those points.
Not quite everything. You don't agree with her argument that Congress was free to make a determination as to zero.
Well, that is exactly right, Your Honor. In fact, that really is a fundamental aspect of this that requires rejection of everything that courts has argued on the zero methodology. And that is, we argue that the statute requires the use of zero. The question of whether zeroing is required by the statute is a fundamental threshold question that this court must address.
Can you send that back to Commerce to weigh in light of the things that are changing?
You certainly could do that, Your Honor, but I think it's plain on the face of the statute and given the structure of the statute and Congress's purpose in enacting the statute.
Would you urge us to send it back to get that kind of assessment?
Well, I would actually urge you to make that decision on your own, which I think you can do that. Now, if you felt the need to remand it back to Congress, I think you certainly could do that. But again, I think you can make that on the basis of the statute and its structure and purpose here. And the fact is, Congress' purpose and intent is judicially ascertainable here, and that purpose and intent is to require zeroing. Now, this court's prior decisions did not find that the statute requires zeroing, but the critical provisions of Section 1677 F1D of the statute were not considered in those decisions.
When you say were not considered, and I haven't gone back and looked at the briefs, perhaps you have. Do you know if those arguments, those provisions were presented to the court and simply not discussed, or do you think that they weren't presented to the court?
Well, I can tell you, in the Timken case, they were not presented to the court. In the original Chorus case, they were presented, in the most recent Chorus case, they were presented to the court, but this court issued a per curiam decision.
Yeah.
So they were not, there was no, it was not addressed at all by the court.
You mean Rule 36, not per curiam decision?
Yeah, I think that's right. Yeah. The fact is that the sole purpose of Section 1677 F1D is to dictate when weighted average or transaction-specific U.S. prices are to be used in calculating a company's dumping margin. But if zeroing is not used, it makes no difference whether you use weighted average or transaction-specific U.S. prices. You get the same exact margin results. In other words, if zeroing is not used, the provisions of Section 1677 F1D are utterly meaningless. Zeroing is required to give meaning and effect to those provisions. It really is as simple and straightforward as that. Now, if you look at Section 1677 F1D, which is attached as an addendum to our brief, it sets forth the comparison methods used by Commerce in calculating dumping margins, in normal investigations without targeted dumping, investigations with targeted dumping, and administrative reviews. These provisions clearly show that it was essential to Congress that a particular comparison method be used to calculate dumping margins, either by comparing normal values to weighted average U.S. prices or by comparing normal values to transaction-specific U.S. prices, depending on the circumstances of the case. These different comparison methods must have been intended by Congress to have different results. Without zeroing, however, it simply does not matter which comparison method is used. The end result will always be the same. For example, if zeroing is not used in an administrative review like the review at issue here, Commerce will get the same margin result, regardless of whether it compares normal values to weighted average U.S. prices or to transaction-specific U.S. prices. If zeroing is not used, it makes no difference whatsoever as to which of the two comparison methods is used. The end result will always be the same, and that can be shown to a mathematical certainty. All this shows that the statute does not merely authorize zeroing, it requires it.
Remaining, I think around 4 minutes.
I think that would be plenty, Your Honor.
4 minutes.
Let me clarify a few quick things. First, please don't get confused and think this case is like Timken or like Korrestal. We are not challenging the method of computation used by Commerce in the review. Our point is that Commerce had no authority to impose duties, whatever the computation they used, whatever the the rate of duty, because the order has been revoked and that question remains open for review determination as to its effect, and that the determination of dumping is no longer valid. And
the change in policy seems to apply to investigations.
Correct. And it is the investigation determination that we agree with Commerce on had to be changed. They did, in fact, apply the new rule, the new methodology, the new law to this investigation. They said they were going to do so in their 123 decision, and they did. And the result of it was no dumping is appropriate to be found in that investigation. It is the effect of that that they have not taken into account, that they must take into account. And under Parkdale, is to be taken into account on the basis of prospectivity determined by...
But Ms. Burke says if we send it back, they'll just do the same.
Now, that brings me to my last point. You're doing my segues very good. They say they determined all of this in the fourth annual review. Not so, Your Honor. First of all, they have not even addressed the effect of the 123 determination and its... and its invalidation of the affirmative determination of dumping. Second, as to the 129 determination, They have said what they are going to do, and they begin their discussion in this instance. I'm not quite sure that means in this case or in the issue of zeroing. They say the department lacks sufficient experience with such situations to establish general guidelines. And they say 129 does not itself require them to make a decision either way. But let's suppose they had decided in the review number 4 that they weren't going to, that they rejected all these arguments and they found they had authority. We believe that decision is wrong. We're going to appeal review number 4. They have to make that same decision in this review so that we have the right to appeal that. Failure, that's what you have to remand for at the very least, because that's the way the judicial system operates.
But I'm not sure why you're in a different position if you go back and you get the same answer that you got in review 4. In this case, how does that put you in a different position with respect to your legal arguments that you're presenting now to us?
First of all, we have no answer as to 123. They don't address 123 or its effect, as they're required to do to determine the applicability of their change in methodology and the effect of that change in methodology. They haven't addressed that at all, so at the very least, we need to go back for that. Secondly, as to the 129 decision, now remember, this is a different case. It's not a pure 129 where they just changed the result of investigation. This is a 123 with a different statutory scheme that has different consequences intended by the Congress when they change the law. And that's what they've done here. But anyway, go back to the 129. They've said they made this determination in this case. It looks wrong to us. We're going to appeal it. It's not clear that they've made it on, because they say they lack sufficient experience with such situations to establish general guidelines. It's not clear they've made the same decision in our case. I'm not sure. I find their decision confusing. In the fourth review, they sometimes seem to be talking about what's the appropriate method of calculation.
Is there a material difference between the two? That would give us some reason to think they would reach a different result?
I don't know, because it's not clear to me on what basis they made this determination here. Some of their language seems to talk about the issue you were posing, Your Honor, which is, gee, is the methodology correct that we used in the review? That's not our argument at all. Our argument is to the authority. It's not clear how they reached that decision. And all that needs to be clarified, and at the very least, if they're going to do that, we have to be given a chance to appeal it. Otherwise, our right as to those $3.5-4 million worth of duties, deposits, is gone.
Thank you, Mr. Cunningham.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Next case will be Cricket.